thing, so this is always a good thing too. Okay, so what I'm going to tell you about today is kind of a short talk with a very long introduction. I'm going to talk about the properties of black strings. I was sort of hoping that Ray LaFrance would be here so that I could refer all questions about the subject to him, but I guess since he's not here, he can't contradict me when I say stuff about him, so maybe that's good too. Anyway, this is some work that I've done in collaboration with Louise Lehner and Franz Pretorius, and it appears on GRQC and has been accepted for publication in Quizrec. In fact, we just got page proofs yesterday, so yeah, we'll see. Okay, so.
Everybody's curious about this.
Yeah, one for number four.
Oh. let's see. all right, I must have got the number wrong. Sorry about that. Last infected a new month. Anyway, the idea is the following. Let me first tell you about the sort of introductory parts, and then I'll tell you about the two parts. So, roughly speaking, it's been known for some time that black strings are unstable, but it hasn't been known sort of what they evolved to. There's been a bit of a controversy over that. So, what I'm going to do is to tell you first about what black strings are and about the nature of their instability. And then in two, I'll tell you about sort of an argument about what happens to them. Three is a numerical simulation that attempted to resolve the argument but didn't quite succeed. So one, two, and three are the sort of old stuff. And then four is the new project that hopes to shed some light on this issue using the old numerical simulation but analyzing its data in a new way. And then I'll tell you the results and then the conclusion. Okay. Also, I should mention, although this crowd doesn't look quite as rowdy as the usual perimeter crowd, so it sort of looks like a combination of the usual, rowdy perimeter crowd and the not quite so rowdy, rowdy talk crowd. But nonetheless, feel free to, sort of jump in at any time with questions or editorial comments or, suggestions for different delivery style or something like that. So let's begin. In general relativity, for a long time, we had the notion that, we're supposed to find solutions of the Einstein field equations, but in four space-time dimensions, because that's the number of dimensions that we live in. But string theory tells us that, in fact, we're supposed to live in some larger number of dimensions, but the extra ones not noticed because they're compactified and small. And so what that means is that, in some sense, the arena in which we're supposed to look for solutions of the field equations and examine their properties has become much bigger. In Rob's words and Louise's words, we were scanning new horizons, looking at general relativity beyond four dimensions. So the simplest thing that one could imagine to look at is to just say, what does general relativity look like in five dimensions? Once we add one extra dimension, what happens? So in particular, I want to remind you that if we take some vacuum space-time, you just take its cross product with another vacuum space-time, it still satisfies the vacuum field equations. So what that means is that if we take a plain old ordinary spherical black hole, a Schwarzschild black hole in four dimensions, and we just cross it with a circle, that's still a solution of the vacuum Einstein equations, but now in five space-time dimensions instead of four. So that space-time, Schwarzschild cross the circle, is what's referred to as a black string. And so now one can ask, what are the properties of a black string? And in particular, one of the first things that you want to know about any solution is it stable? That is, if you kick it a little bit, does it just bring a little bit and go back to what it was before, or does it evolve to something radically different? Only solutions that are stable can represent the physical end states of some evolution. So for both the four-dimensional black hole and the five-dimensional black string, we would want to ask the question, are they stable? So it turns out that the way you ask that question is you just use perturbation theory. That is, you solve the vacuum Einstein equations to first order in the solution you're interested in plus a little piece. For things that are static, you can then look for solutions that separate, namely a function of space times a function of time. The function of space can then only be an exponential, and if that exponential factor has a positive real part, then you've got an exponentially growing mode and you've got an instability. So both for the four-dimensional Schwarzschild metric and the five-dimensional black string metric, one can, using perturbation theory, ask this question, is it stable? That is, are there not exponentially growing modes? For black holes, the four-dimensional Schwarzschild metric, it's been known for some time that the answer is they're stable. There are no exponentially growing modes. But for black strings, the black string is unstable. Ruth Gregory and Ray LaFlamme showed that there is actually an exponentially growing mode. And the presence or absence of an exponentially growing mode depends on the size of this extra circle that you add. If you add a sufficiently small extra circle, it's stable. But if the extra circle gets big enough, there's an exponentially growing mode that's unstable. So when we add one extra dimension, we get this funny property. Black holes are stable, but black strings are unstable. Okay, so it's unstable, it's not the end state. It must evolve to something else. The turbo black string, and it changes and it evolves to some other thing. So the question is, what does an unstable black string evolve to? Ruth Gregory and Ray LaFlamme thought they had the answer for that, and they very well have. And their answer is based on a simple argument involving entropy. So for both black holes and black strings, the entropy is the area of the object. And so one can ask the question, well, is there something that it could evolve to that has higher entropy? If there is, well, maybe that's what it evolves to. So what they notice is that for the case where the circle is long enough that black strings are unstable, that the black string actually has less entropy than a collection of black holes with the same mass. And so they conjectured quite reasonably that what happens is that a black string simply pinches off parts of it narrow and parts of it get wider, and then it becomes a set of black holes. Yeah?
So the entropy doesn't depend on how many pinching offs, I mean, collection of how many black holes the end result is.
Oh yeah, definitely. But what they notice is that whenever the circle is long enough that that there is an instability, there is some number of black holes, depending on the size of the circle, that has higher entropy than the original black string. So how many black holes you get depends on the particular length of the circle. So if the length of the circle is too small, then you don't pinch off at all. And depending on how long the length of the circle is, you might pinch off into some number of black holes.
But if the circle's alive, it's infinitely long.
Well, so these things always go on Schwarzschild process one. If the circle is a line, you have sort of massive questions about what boundary conditions are allowed to put on the perturbation, and so the problem becomes less well defined. And the entropy argument also becomes less well defined because if you're going from something with infinite entropy to something that also has infinite entropy. This isn't one of those cases where it's clear that one infinity is bigger than the other. So to make the problem, sort of tractable and well defined, it's always done as Schwarzschild cross the circle rather than Schwarzschild cross the line. You could try to address the Schwarzschild cross the line question, but it would be harder. Okay, so this was a nice, simple argument, made physical sense. Everybody was sure it was right, until a couple of guys, Gary Horowitz and Kingo Maeda, got into the act and used some arguments from global structure, the same sort of methods used to prove the singularity theorems, to cast doubt on this notion that blacks experience pinball into black holes. So basically, what they noticed was that if you take a look at the horizon of the black string, so the horizon is generated by null geodesics, the light rays that just barely don't escape to infinity and just barely don't fall into the black hole. Suppose you look at the horizon and you consider what happens to the horizon as a function of the affine parameter of those geodesics. Then it turns out that you can prove a theorem that, and these guys did prove a theorem, that if the pinch-off happens in a finite affine parameter, it must be preceded by a singularity. Now, the existence of a singularity is not surprising. After all, there's a singularity inside the black string, and if you pinch off to zero radius, you're getting closer and closer to the singularity, curvature is getting bigger and bigger. So no one is surprised by the notion that the actual pinch-off itself would result in a singularity. But what these guys showed is that if you assume that no singularity occurs until the pinch-off, you actually get a contradiction. That if you want to pinch off in a finite affine parameter, then somehow the space-time must become singular before that happens. And so their conclusion then is that things don't pinch off in finite affine parameter. Yeah, Peter?
Is it singularity or some sort of a more generalized motion of singularity?
So these are the same methods that Hawking and Penrose used to prove singularity theorems. And so for them, singularity just means geodesically incomplete, geodesics end for some unspecified reason. And so it's the same sort of thing here as it is for them. Yeah,
so I was going to ask you if they tell you where the singularity is supposed to form.
So the singularity must form either outside the horizon or on the horizon, and it must form in such a way that the place where the pinch-off happens has to be sort of cut out of the domain of dependence. In other words, the pinch-off can see the singularity. Okay, so how do they prove this? What's going on? Well, the method is essentially the same sort of method as used for the area theorem, the one that says that black hole areas have to increase. You use the fact that the horizon is the boundary of the cast of future null infinity to show that, in fact, the horizon must always have non-negative expansion. And then what they do is they use something called Ray-Chiduri's equation, which relates the expansion and shear of the horizon. So the expansion, in case of the black string, what you want to think of is that there are two things going on. One is the shrinking of the spheres to make a pinch-off, and then there is expansion in the direction, in the z-direction, of spheres. So, from these general global considerations of the fact that it's a horizon, the expansion must increase, or at least not decrease. So any contraction in the sphere direction must be compensated for by at least an equal expansion in the z direction, the fifth direction. So at first sight, that doesn't sound so bad, except that if you have different expansions in different directions, that gives rise to a shear, this quantity sigma. But now if you have big shear, then according to Ray-Chiduri's equation, that tends to drive the expansion in negative directions. The upshot is that by demanding that you want to have pinch-off, that is that the two-sphere direction has to go all the way to zero in finite affine parameter, And you want that to be consistent with the expansion, never getting negative, you find you can't do it according to Ray Chaudhuri's equation. So what these guys showed is that unless somehow the whole process is interrupted by the formation of a singularity before this pinch off, you cannot have a pinch off in finite Atlanta ground. Okay, so this sort of physically reasonable situation that Gregory and Laplace told us ought to happen is now proved to be, in some sense, inconsistent with Einstein's equation.
So it'd be unfair to ask people for looking at the safety more, a little bit more about how the singularity is supposed to prevent, well, to see, I mean, it's the fact that it just needs to be shot.
So these, you know, one of these annoying global structure proofs that proceeds by contradiction. And so you never have any, you know, sort of notion of you know, what is the mechanism. So the idea is simply that if there is no singularity preceding the pinch off, then the expansion has to be positive all the way to pinch off, and that shows the basis of the Ray Chaudhuri's equation. Yeah, so that's all that's going on. It's not that there's a particular mechanism in the singularity that's somehow, you know, sort of making things okay. It's just that the absence of singularities implies expansion positive all the way to pinch off, and that in Ray Chaudhuri's equation is shown to generate a contribution.
Both those terms have to be positive.
Yes.
Sigma theta d lambda has to be negative, basically. That's essentially the process.
Yes, the theta d lambda has to be negative, but not so negative that it ever, that theta ever goes negative.
Negative. Right,
right. So, no, so that's the delicate balance.
The problem is in that process, there's no way to stop that.
Well, the problem is that you have a contraction in the two-sphere direction that has to go all the way to zero. And at least corresponding expansion in the opposite direction. And that generates lots of shear. And so the problem is that there's no way.
Yeah, I understand that. But the idea of the proof is just that the anticipated process is driving the theta d lambda to be negative, and there appears to be no way to stop theta itself from becoming negative.
Yes. Well, in fact, you can prove that there's no way to stop theta itself.
That's right. So that's basically for us.
Yeah, that's the whole proof. Yeah, that's all there is to it. Yeah.
The area expansion here for the horizon is it local, right? It's the total area of the horizon that cannot be proved. Or is it local?
So in the Hawking area theorem, the stated result at the end that the total area of the horizon increases. But the method of proof is essentially to first prove that the expansion must increase. That the expansion is positive, and then to use that to show that since the change in time of the volume is the integral of the expansion, that therefore the area has to increase. So it's true that you can't conclude from area increase that theta has to be positive, because as you say, the total area could increase with theta being positive somewhere and negative somewhere else. But the method of the area theorem proof first shows that theta has to be positive, and then uses that to prove that area increases. So this is not something where you just say, I'm taking the result of the area theorem and I'm using it to show that theta is positive. Rather, I'm just saying that the method of proof here is essentially the same as the method of proof of the area in Europe. Okay, does that answer your question? So basically, unless catastrophic singularity happens before pinch off, there's no pinch off to finite Atlanta parameter. But there's one little loophole, which is that the theorem doesn't rule out pinch off an infinite Atlanta parameter. So instead, what these guys have is an argument that they claim rules out pinch off and infinite Atlanta parameter. And the argument is simply that if we go back to Ray Chaudhuri's equation, while it's possible to have pinch off and infinite Atlanta parameter, it looks on the face of it like a very delicate balancing act. because you want to do it very, very slowly. You still somehow want to get the radius down to zero, but you can't do it too quickly, otherwise you're going to have a bunch of shear that's going to drop day to day. So it's barely consistent with Ray Chaudhuri's equation to have pinch off an infinite affine parameter, but on the face of it, you have to do things in what looks like a very slow way. So in particular, no power law in affine parameter will work. Either the power law will be too slow and the radius won't go to zero, or the power law will be too quick and the inconsistent with Ray Chaudhuri's equation. So they argue, well, you know, we haven't got a theorem that rules out pinch off an infinite affine parameter, but it looks, you know, ridiculously unnaturally slow, and, you know, it just doesn't look like it would happen. So these guys basically conclude that, okay, pinch off doesn't happen. Okay, so we have a sort of nice physical argument from Gregory and Laflamme that says pinch off ought to happen. We have this high-powered theorem and not quite so high-powered argument by Horowitz and Maeda that says pinch off can happen. So who's right? Well, we don't know. And so, yeah.
So the Gregory Laflamme argument tells you that the first is supposed to be a classical. So it's based on the thermodynamics. So now you are trying to discuss whether the pinch off can be, whether a general relativity allows the pinch off. Once you reach correction for the curvature is high,
quantum tunnel, the black hole.
Well, I mean, the thermodynamic argument doesn't tell you that the process is classical. At some point, you're going to be classical. Yes, but the thermodynamic argument is not about the classical velocity.
No, no, it's not. It's about the trajectory of the
Venus.
Sure.
So it tells you something about the potential final state, but it doesn't tell you that the evolution has to be classical all the time.
Sure. But typically, I mean, quantum corrections to these evolutions become important when curvatures reach the quantum scale. If what happens in the classical theory is you come within a sort of quantum scale of getting to a pinch off, that's you know, pretty close to a pinch off. So we can still ask the question, what does the classical theory predict?
But that would be allowed by the Horowitz Maeda argument.
Yes. So the physical arguments don't tell us the answer, the theorems don't tell us the answer. But one way to figure out the answer to properties of some solutions of the Einstein field equations is to just go ahead and do a computer simulation. So we go ahead and write down a sort of finite difference version of the field equations, put them on the computer, and see what happens. So that was attempted by this group of people, UBC collaboration, and they have their results available in PhysRedT. And the basic idea is the following. So you write the metric in this form with this scalar alpha, this sort of vector beta, and then the sort of spatial metric gamma. Where here, this superscript A means that we're dealing with either R or C, the only variables other than time that things depend on. So from the vacuum Einstein equations, what you get are evolution equations, things that are second order in space and time, for this spatial metric, gamma AB and gamma omega. And you're allowed to freely specify a lapse alpha and shift theta to be anything that you want. So the idea then is that what these guys did was to write a computer program that implements that equation and see what happens. Okay, so what do they do? So they start from the static black string without, and then they slightly perturb it. That is, they add a little bit of the regularly Laflamme unstable mode, and then they evolve it and see what happens. So on the bottom is a picture from their paper of what the black string sort of looks like. And this is an embedding diagram. This is basically something that's sort of R as a function of C that has the same spatial curvature as the thing in their simulation. So things start out, you know, with just a tiny bit of wiggles. By time 113 in their simulation, the wiggles have become pronounced, and then they get more and more pronounced. And in the end, what you have is something that looks like a bunch of round black holes connected by very long, thin strings. In other words, this looks to everybody but Gary Horowitz like the string is trying to pinch off these black holes. But Gary does the big stuff. Unfortunately, what happens is that a little bit after here, the code crashes. It can't follow the evolution any further than this. I like to refer this as a punch bowl effect for reasons that I'll now explain to you. So some of you may know that in economics, it's the role of the central bank to adjust interest rates to keep the economy from, you know, either going too low or going too high. And in particular, the part about keeping the economy from going too high and keeping inflation from running off was once referred to in the following terms by one U.S. central banker. He said, the role of the Federal Reserve Bank is to take the punch bowl away just when the party starts to get going. Inadvertently, although that's not what these guys had in mind, their code does the same thing. And the reason is the following. General relativity doesn't tell you what you're supposed to choose for the lapse of shift. Those basically just say how your time slices evolve. And if you choose them wrong, your evolution will become ill-defined, your spatial derivatives will become too big, and your code will not be able to go on. So what did these guys do in their choice for lapse and shift? Well, since they were just starting out in this problem, they picked a lapse and shift that were nicely tailored to keep anything near a straight, non-wiggly black string evolving the way it should. So in other words, their code was tailored to something that was fairly close to a non-wiggly black string. And then when the string gets too wiggly, then their code and their choice of lapse and shift don't work anymore. In other words, just when things get interesting, their choice of gauge doesn't work well anymore. They've taken the punch bowl away just when the party is getting really good. So this code, although its results are very suggestive, does not resolve the issue of what happens to a long string, black string. Okay, so now I've told you all the old stuff. Now it's time to tell you the new stuff. So Rob and I organized last year a conference at Perimeter on sort of a test run for the Santa Barbara conference. And it was also called New Horizons GR Beyond 40. And so we brought a whole bunch of people who know lots about black strings here and argued with them about things. And in particular, I got to talking to Luis Lehner and Franz Pretorius, and I asked them the following question. What happens in their simulations to the affine parameter and the shear and the expansion of the horizon? And they said, well, we don't know. We never looked at that stuff. So I said, OK, let's look at that stuff. Let's take the data in your simulations, look at the horizon, and calculate the affine parameter, the expansion, and the shear. So this, in a nutshell, is what I'm going to spend the rest of the time talking about, that calculation of those. So the first thing you have to do is define the horizon. And it turns out that there's a nice, sophisticated way of doing that. What you basically do is you go to the end of the simulation and you trace light rays backwards. The horizon is the boundary of those light rays that, when going forward, just barely get to infinity. And therefore, it's the place where the light rays pile up when you trace them backwards. So that's a nice sophisticated method, but in the end it turns out that the event horizon you trace out in this way is well approximated for basically the entire simulation by the apparent horizon. That is the place where locally light rays are just barely have a very small expansion. Okay, so now you have this horizon. And what you can do is you can write down the horizon as the radial coordinate r, some function of t in z, that basically just says you found the horizon. So that means the normal to that horizon is just the gradient of little r minus capital R. But for a null surface, the normal is the same as the light rays that generate that. So you basically found the geodesics. These geodesics are not affinely parameterized, and so this quantity k, the gradient of the surface, is related as something L, the affine parameterized geodesic, is something times k, and you can calculate this quantity nu. So now you've found the affine parameter, and you've also found affinely parameterized geodesic. Okay, so how do you find the expansion and the shear? Well, these are basically just components of the gradient of the known geodesic L. And in particular, because of the symmetry, there are only two independent components, one in the two-sphere direction and one in the direction orthogonal. So in particular, we can calculate this quantity A. I'll explain later on why this two and minus sign are there. But basically, we calculate this quantity A, that's the two-sphere piece of the gradient of the null geodesic, and this quantity B, that's the other piece of the gradient. And then the expansion and shear are given in the following way. Expansion is just A minus B, and the shear is just 1/6 A plus 2B quantity squared. So all of these things you can calculate numerically. For reasons that will also become clear a little bit later, we like to work with logarithmic and rescale quantities. That is, instead of working with the affine parameter lambda, we're going to work with this quantity s, which is logarithmic lambda. And instead of working with the shear theta, we want to work with this quantity theta tilde, which is the affine parameter times the expansion, theta tilde, which is the affine parameter times the expansion, and a rescaled shear, sigma tilde, which is the affine parameter times the shear. So all of these things, we just take the data from their code, we find the geodesics, we find the affine parameter, we use that to calculate the expansion and shear. Okay? All right, so now I want to show you some results of this calculation from the simulation. So this graph is actually three different curves, and I should explain sort of why the three different ones. So I tend to do numerics in a very sloppy way for the simulation. I say, here are my results. But Luis and Franz are much more careful. You know, the numerical simulation doesn't mean anything until you show that it's accurate and convergent. And so what you want to do is to run the simulation at three different resolutions and show that the results from those three different resolutions are converging to an answer. So in particular, we looked at the simulations run at several different point sizes in the R, point numbers in the R and Z direction. So this dashed line is the lowest resolution, the dotted line is an intermediate resolution, and the solid line is the line of highest resolution. And what we have is plotted here as a function of simulation time, t, is s, the log of the affine parameter. Okay? And since we have these three graphs at different resolutions, and they're going towards each other, then more confident that we have it on points that in the conversion regime the results will be trusted. Okay, so this innocuous looking graph is actually the most important part of this talk. And I'll explain why in a second. So at first sight, it doesn't, you know, sort of look all that bad. I mean, after all, the simulation time goes up to about 150. In that time, s goes to about 50. It's sort of doing it linearly here, and then it's going up a little bit. But the thing to remember is that s is the log of the affine parameter. So that means that the affine parameter itself is getting absolutely enormous. By the end of the simulation, the affine parameter is about even 50. Okay, so let me emphasize this again. At the end of the simulation, the affine parameter has reached a value of about 10 to the 21st. Okay, so this is what affine parameter does. What is expansion and shear? So again, let me show you a graph of the simulation. This is a graph of the rescaled expansion. So this is affine parameter times expansion. And again, this thing is done at these three different resolutions when things are converging nicely to the result. And so this thing is sort of a border one or less. And now let me show you a similar graph for the shear. So this is the rescaled shear support. So things are sort of a little bit ratty at the lowest resolution, but again, they seem to be converging nicely. And this rescale shear squared is also about a border one. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, remember that the rescaled expansion and shear are affine parameter times the real expansion and shear. Furthermore, the affine parameter by the end of the simulation has reached a value of about 10 to the 21. So what that means is that by the end of the simulation, the expansion and the shear are of order 10 to the minus 22. In other words, what's going on in the simulation is that the expansion and shear are behaving in this unnaturally small, unnaturally slow way that Horowitz and Maeda told us was needed for a pinch off an infinite affine parameter. So in other words, things are happening in just such a way as to be the tiny and slow behavior that the theorem tells us is needed if things are going to pinch off an affine parameter. So as often happens with numerical simulations, you get a result, and someone tells you, oh, you should have expected this to begin with, that they're actually right. So in this case, it was Eric who explained this to me, but he wants to have plausible deniability and disavow all knowledge of this because he doesn't want to annoy Harry, whereas I have no such compunctions. But anyway, the point that Eric explained to me is that in the Schwarzschild space-time, there's this well-known result that says that affine parameter on the horizon is an exponential function of, in this case, advanced time, where the exponential is exponential of advanced time divided by 4m. So it's not surprising that affine parameters behave exponentially on horizons. That's what they do on the Schwarzschild horizon, and the black string at least starts off at Schwarzschild plus some other dimension. So in fact, we really should expect really big affine parameters, and correspondingly, we should expect really small expansions of shear. In other words, what Horowitz and Maeda told us was unnaturally slow and unnaturally small is in fact the sort of thing that we should have guessed would have been natural if we had paid more attention to what affine parameter does in the presence of black holes. Another way of looking at this is that if one wants a natural dynamical time for this problem, then in some sense, the log of the affine parameter is a much more natural dynamical time than the affine parameter. And in fact, if you write things in terms of log of affine parameter, you find that simple power laws do allow you to get pinch off an infinite affine parameter. Okay, so let me now conclude. So the basic conclusion, well, there are sort of three of them. So pinch off an infinite affine parameter is possible. There was only an argument against it anyway, and that argument is now shown to be invalid. It was regarded as unnaturally small and unnaturally slow, and the argument is, in fact, the natural dynamical time scale and is the time scale that the simulations show the black string actually takes. One other conclusion is that infinite affine parameter need not mean infinite time, or at least infinite time as seen by the simulation or as seen by the observers at infinity. Remember that at Schwarzschild, the exponential is time divided by 4 times mass. if what stands in place of the mass is really the radius of the horizon, and then as the horizon shrinks, that time scale could actually increase. And in fact, from the simulations, one sees that the log of the affine parameter, which starts out as linear, is actually becoming more and more steep as you get towards the end of the simulation. So even if the pinch off occurs at infinite affine parameter, it could still occur in a finite time as measured by any reasonable definition of time in the system.
So before I answer the gravity, you certainly have to consider the gravity increase.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So pinch off an infinite affine parameter is possible, and looks to me at least as the most plausible of the outcomes. However, one still needs better numerical simulations to resolve the issue, and in fact, UBC group is working on a better version of the numerical simulation than what we'll get the answer. Although this last phrase, better numerical simulations are needed to resolve the issue, Luis Lehner claims is used so much that he's written a tech macro that just puts that phrase in the picture. That's it for the talk. Thank you.
Possible outcomes of this particular topic, though, is there could be self-similar pinch-off behavior. So this thin string between the two big ones could itself develop little black holes, and in between them, more and more. Is there any evidence this could possibly happen?
So that's a very good question. So if we take a look at the embedding diagram, the embedding diagram looks like a bunch of black holes and a bunch of long straight strings. And so one natural thing to say, as you just said, is a lot of people have said is, look, maybe these long thin necks themselves behave like long straight static strings, and they too are subject to a greater than Planck instability, which then makes them pinch off and become small black holes connected by short necks, which themselves pinch off, and so on and so on. And that could happen, so this sort of cascade effect could give you pinch off in finite time and infinite affine parameter. And in fact, in our paper, we mentioned that explicitly as one of the possibilities. The problem is that despite the embedding diagram, even these long thin necks don't, at least in the simulation, show signs that they've sort of settled down. That is, they're still changing rapidly towards the end of the simulation. So this cascade would work if there's a time in which, the sort of long thin neck has really stopped changing, and it's just, essentially a long straight black string with a little perturbation, which then itself undergoes the instability. So the simulations don't yet indicate that that's what's happened, because they haven't gone far enough to say whether this long thin neck is going to pinch off all the way to zero, or is going to stop pinching until another instability kicks in. So this is yet another case where better simulations are needed. So this macro at least has become really useful for majors. Let's see, David and then Peter.
Since the presence of the variable of time stability depends on having long enough radius for the circle, even if these bits settle down, you need them to be of a minimal length.
They're definitely of that minimal length, because what counts is the ratio of the radius to the length. This is very long and very thin by those standards. So this little segment here is already long and thin enough that a very critical quantum instability would set in if it were static. So that part we can get for free. Peter and then Eric.
Okay. Is there any understanding of what the time scale of the... So suppose I have a long thin string that is static,
as opposed to an even longer, but thicker string that I started with before, would the time scale could be of these instabilities set in these two cases? I mean, my point of view is that since this is already a numerical simulation, if I'm numerically simulating something that's unstable, it should show it being unstable right away, unless the time scale for the onset of the instability in the thin string is somehow much longer than the onset of the instability in the thicker but longer string.
No, the time scale should definitely be short because general relativity is scalar here. And since the radius is getting smaller, the time scale should be shorter as well.
Then I would say, since this is already a numerical simulation, where the instability would show up no matter what I do, because it's a numerical simulation, if it doesn't show up, it's probably not viewed as a,
well,
it's another case of a thin, long string which is going to develop.
Well, I'm sympathetic to that point of view, and I actually agree with you. But on the other side, one can point out that the thing that's unstable is the static black strip, and so the instability shouldn't set in until the neck stops shrinking. And from the simulation, the neck has not stopped shrinking. So that's where we bring the later macro in again and say there are numerical simulations that need it. Eric,
can I ask you a question? Can you say anything about the relationship between the number of beads and the length of the circle? Is it just a linear function?
Oh, so actually, this is in some sense a sort of cheat, which I didn't mention. I mean, there's really only one bead here. They sort of artificially expanded the domain that they were planning things out. For illustrative purposes. I think it's true that you're likely to get sort of more beads with a bigger length, but I don't know whether this simulation is actually showing that.
What's going to happen to all this if you put some angular momentum into the problem?
This is sort of a nasty numerical problem, right? Because the point is you're already adding an extra dimension because of Z. And then what you have is a problem that's 2 plus 1 dimensional because it's spherically symmetric, so that this ordinary spatial coordinates depends only on R. And then in addition, it depends on Z and on T. So now you come along and you say, well, I want some angular momentum. So now if you have angular momentum, things are going to be at most axisymmetric. So they're going to depend on R, theta, Z, and T. They're also going to have an axis at theta equals 0 and pi, where there are sort of nasty numerical problems of keeping things stable on the axis. And so you have, all of the nastiness of 3 plus 1 numerical relativity trying to get the resolution you need, plus the added nastiness that people doing 3 plus 1 numerical relativity don't have because they don't have to deal with an axis. And then everybody will throw up their hands and say, forget it, we're out of the simulation.
How about the level of revision?
What's that? So, for black holes, we use the Tucholsky equation because in spherical symmetry, there's no degrees of freedom. So we can't say, we can't talk about spherically symmetric perturbations because there really aren't. Here, the idea is that the Gregory-Laplan instability is a spherically symmetric perturbation, and so we can get away with that. Nothing, I think, prevents you from writing down a Tucholsky type equation so let's see. So you could, in fact, if you really wanted to make it interesting, you could write down, a curve across a circle, and then write down sort of the equivalent Tucholsky equation for that and see what happens.
Has anybody tried that? Has anybody known?
Yeah, not that I know of. I mean, since there already is, you know, a spiritless metric instability, I think people have the notion that, well, let's keep our life as simple as possible. But you're right. I mean, the numerical problem sounds pretty tough, but the perturbation theory problem of trying to do the perturbation theory on a curve across a circle doesn't sound that hard. I mean, that sounds doable. I don't know of anybody who's particularly decided they want to do it, but I don't see any obstacle.
Your momentum might stabilize.
That's what I would expect to be for rational stability.
I'm not so sure. But that's
more interesting. If the spread spinning about the set axis, I expect there to be, it would reduce the
ill. There's no reason you can't be organized as spin. I mean, it's just spin, you could just all plumb up.
Yeah, but that's why it's interesting. They don't know.
Okay, but I don't think it's natural. Well, I don't think it's obvious that it's stable. I'd also add that these Mikulski equations are a lot harder than just saying, here's an equation. In particular, they're written in four dimensions where you're relying on twister techniques.
Yes.
And so if you're going to an odd number of dimensions, you have to start from ground zero and start over again. So,
But see, Eric is really good at calculating.
It's not obvious it will stabilize it, but it's not obvious it will not stabilize it. That's why it's interesting. You don't know. That's my whole point.
Yeah. Well, so given the two problems, the numerical one and the perturbation theory one, I think the perturbation theory one is less difficult, although I agree with Rob that it has its own difficulties. Other questions or comments?
Actually, I had a question, which was another idea that you talked about last spring was sort of focusing in on these narrow strips and hoping that it looks like Casper or something, and just trying to approximate the behavior there with some known solution. Or I thought that was something that I just wanted
The only place that it's gone is to ask, is there a simple analytic form for the behavior of the horizon that's consistent with the range of Erings equation? That was the thing that was, and in a way, the answer was already known in the Horowitz and Maeda paper. At one point, they say, you can have a pinch-off infinite affine parameter, but it has this, sort of really nasty dependence on logarithm of the affine parameter to some power. Well, in our language, that basically just says, a power law in S, our natural variable, is behavior that's perfectly consistent with Pinchoff and with Pinchoff and infinite affine parameter and with Rayleigh-Jeffers equation. So the only place that project has gone is to just show that you can satisfy all the equations with a power law. But since you can satisfy it with a whole bunch of power laws, you don't get any advanced.
Well, power laws is what you expect from price type decay of radiation in the black hole, or maybe it's a space time. So here you don't quite have synthetic properties, but the power law might be what you expect to have.
Don't you pull particular power laws out of the black hole case? I mean, here all we find is that, there's a sort of range of powers that are consistent with the equation. So
I think that may be a calculation based on a test field in the background that tell you what power is a thing, and it might correspond to your characteristics.
The problem is that this is no longer a slightly perturbed straight black strip. And we're talking about this net actually shrinking to zero under some power. And that's not close to any, sort of known spacing. So I'm not sure that these sort of techniques that we'll use in black holes work, but maybe they would.
It
need to pick up power out of those or not?
So we sort of thought of that, and in the end we have to apply at least this macro. So here's the decay, right? I mean, so right here, what you have is things are zero because they're just straight string with a little perturbation. The perturbation gets big, it gets go up, and now they decay. Okay, so now we look at this part of the graph, sort of shortly before the simulation crashes. So if we were, sort of a normal numerical relativity group, we would say, we'll take these last, 23 data points and put them to a power law, here's the answer. But these guys were trained by Matt Choptiwicz, so they absolutely refused to do any such nonsense, and they just say, look, we're not getting the asymptotic regime, and you have to get the asymptotic regime to read off the power law. And so all we know is that, the simulation has to go further before we can say anything.
What sets the scale of the location and height of the peak? And width for that?
From my point of view, assuming for a second let me sort of preface this with an old quote from Monty Python. There's an old Monty Python skit where they have this person named Anne Elk. She's really excited. She has this wonderful theory. And, she sort of says, I have this theory a whole bunch, and finally, at the end, the interviewer asks, well, what is this theory that you have? And she says, my theory is that all brontosauruses are thin at one end, much, much thicker in the middle, and then thin again at the other. So let's apply that to this graph. Okay. At this end, it's a small perturbation. So it's got to be small. At this end, it's got to go to zero to be consistent with Ray Tiberius equation. And then in the middle, it gets to be bigger. So, I think that's really all that's going on. This satisfies the NL theory just because we have good reasons for why it has to be small at this end and small at that. Okay, because it's in the middle. What sets the scale of getting to the peak is just the exponential time scale having to do with the Gregorian constant. In other words, if you have an instability that's growing at some exponential rate, and so that sort of gets you up here, and then somehow or another that has to go back down to zero consistent with Ray Tiberius equation. And so I think that's really all that's going on. Other questions, comments?
Are we supposed to, right at the end, the term goes from being convex to concave? Are we out of a regime where we believe the simulation? Is that really a feature of the...
You mean that little curve?
Yeah.
You mean this bump here?
Well, no, on the other two, it also sort of turned over.
You mean like right at the end?
Yeah.
No, well, that's another fact. That's not. I don't think so, because quasi-normal modes are the sort of thing that you get when you have an actual static solution and you're perturbing it and things are going wrong. You start out with a static solution, but it's an unstable. And towards the end of the simulation, things are still very dynamic. I think quasi-normal modes are not the right picture. We want to take as much as possible intuitive understanding from the treatment of black holes, but I think that only gets us so far, because in the end, what we have is something that's very far from the slight perturbation of a black hole. Another questions, editorial remarks, suggestions for future research? No? Okay, thank you. Thank you. No, I mean, that's very strict. Matt has trained them well.
So then the current, let's see, the rotation.
I mean, you were saying if the power law.
Let's see now. You'd have a rotation axis that's said to be a problem.
Yeah, that's right.
So you really want to put some angular momentum.
I could sort of look at the data points and do this, but I sort of agree with that.
That being said, that's everything.